Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Several years ago, in this same room, we hosted the author Nancy Milford, who'd written a biography of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And she was coming here by train, and her train was delayed almost an hour, so she didn't actually get here till about 8 o'clock at night for a 7 o'clock program. So the people in the room, we were just, you know, what do we do in this awkward situation? So people started to stand up and recite the Edna St. Vincent Millay that they had memorized from childhood, and there were really quite a few of them. So I am guessing there are probably that few here could actually stand up and recite Susan Sontag from memory. That's my guess. But if you are here, you've quite likely engaged with Susan Sontag's work. She's the subject of our discussion tonight. She's was a thinker, an author, a critic whose work challenged, nurtured, and stimulated our own thinking about the world. In 2004, Susan Sontag stood on the stage to receive the Los Angeles Public Library Literary Award. And I thought I would just read a little excerpt of something that she said in that talk that night. She said, "I am sometimes asked if there is something I think writers ought to do. And recently in an interview, I heard myself say, several things, love words, agonize over sentences, and pay attention to the world. No sooner had these perky phrases fallen out of my mouth than I thought of some more recipes for writer's virtue. For instance, be serious, by which I meant never be cynical, and which doesn't preclude being funny. And if you allow me one more, take care to be born at a time when it was likely that you could still be exalted and influenced by Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov. The truth is, whatever it might occur to you to say about what a writer ideally should be, there is always something more." End of Sontag quote. And indeed there is. And so tonight, as we present a conversation about this indispensable writer, centered on a critical study by another equally indispensable writer, Philip Lopate, I think we'll all kind of join in this conversation about what a writer is, what kind of a writer Susan Sontag was, and how her work really defined an era, and it's a very interesting intellectual history that Philip has brought us. I'd never met Philip in person until tonight, though there's several of his books on my shelves at home. He's somewhat of a legend in literary circles. He's an influential poet, essayist, editor, critic, anthologist, and teacher. He's the author of 3 personal essay collections, 2 novels, 2 poetry collections, a memoir of his teaching experiences, and a collection of his movie criticism. He's the recipient of many awards and currently holds the John Cranford Adams Chair at Hofstra University and also teaches in the MFA graduate program at Columbia, the New School, and Bennington. He's in conversation tonight with David L. Ulan, whom I'm sure all of you know as the book editor of the Los Angeles Times. David's the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, and the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology. His voice is part of the real center of LA's literary community, and we're delighted to have David here tonight to interview Philip. Please welcome Philip Lopate and David Ulan. Thank you.
Thanks for missing game one. Okay, so we're going to have a fairly free ranging conversation, which we'll bring you guys into at some point, talking about Sontag, about essay writing, about the nature of one writer thinking about another, about literary culture, about where we are. And so let me start. I mean, you actually, Philip, you open the book by saying, I'm just going to read a little moment, and Philip will read a little bit as well. You open the book by talking about when Ivan Bunin, who knew Chekhov, was asked after the older writer's death to do a biography of him, he hesitated. He waited almost 50 years, accruing nerve, writing his fiction, winning the Nobel Prize, until at the brink of his own death, he composed a small book largely made up of questions about Chekhov and the unknowableness of any human being by another. So with that as a starting point, I'm
curious. And then the next line, yeah. I say, I cannot wait to win the Nobel Prize.
So I couldn't decide whether that meant I can't wait to win it or I can't wait that long.
So. I can't wait that long. So I'm going to jump in now before.
But I wanted to start with that. Start with the particular challenges. They're more specific challenges. But generally, from the point of view of a writer whose work genre-wise overlaps in some way. Both of you were essayists. A writer who knew your subject in some ongoing sense over many years. What are the particular challenges of taking on this kind of project, and what were you thinking?
Well, Princeton University Press said they wanted to start a series called Writers on Writers, and you could pick any writer that you wanted to write a short book, I think they had in mind an impulse book. The truth of the matter is that they had sold a lot of this book called On Bullshit.
Right.
And they wanted to start publishing books that were kind of fun, that you could put by the cash register. And so this was supposed to be a 100-page book. It actually turned out to be closer to 250 because I always write long. Anyway, they approached me and they said, would I be interested in doing one? And I said, yeah, it sounded like a good idea. And, you know, I could do it on anybody, but I proposed Susan Sontag because I thought that if I did it on somebody who I completely worshipped, I would run out of things to say except, you know, he's great, she's great, read it, you'll see, you know. Whereas Sontag, whom I knew slightly, I'd always had kind of mixed feelings about. There were things of hers I loved, things of hers I thought really were misguided. And so it seemed to me that it would be a very good exercise to pick somebody who I had mixed feelings about, because I could figure out what I thought as I was writing. And so the book became an adventure in figuring out what I really thought. Now, the challenge was in part that Sontag, you know, is very revered, respected. Actually, there are people who are very dismissive of her and think she's, you know, of no importance, and others who think she's the greatest intellectual we have. So I knew that I was going to situate myself in a middle ground, that the book was not going to be either worshipful nor was it going to be a hatchet job. I had no interest in writing, you know, it's a lot of work to write a book, so I had no interest in writing a book that would just tear down somebody.
Right.
You know. And I actually had a lot of affection for what Sontag did. But I was scared because I was kind of taking the measure of somebody who was intimidating.
And who was...
Who continued to intimidate beyond the grave.
Well, and as you say in the book, who was in many ways willfully intimidating in terms of the... Yeah. Or could be willfully intimidating in terms of the way that she carried herself both on the page and in the world.
Yeah, I have a section. I ended up with the solution for this book that I would write sections. And by the way, forgive me for both looking at you and looking at the audience, because there's something very schizoid-inducing about doing this, because I want to talk to David, who I really like, and yet I want to face the audience. Anyway, what was I saying? yes, I ended up doing it in sections and called it Notes on Sontag, because she had written Notes on Camp, her most famous essay. So I thought I would do riffs, you know, like a jazz musician, sort of essays, short and long, on different themes, different books, different topics. And one of the sections I wrote was readers feeling stupid. And and it was about, maybe I'll just
You want to read from that?
Read that. Yeah, I wasn't planning to, but why not? I have often heard acquaintances or graduate students, some of the most intelligent, say that when they read Susan Sontag, they felt stupid. As one thoughtful writer friend put it, I feel as if I have one brain and she has two. They seem to be basing the impression partly on Sontag's vast range of cultural and philosophical references, and partly on their struggle to figure out the meaning or emotional drift underneath some of her more impersonal sentences. But I also think it part of her strategy to make the reader feel stupid. She did that occasionally by a calculated use of obscure references, such as Philo of Alexandria, but more often by a prose style that tended toward opaqueness and kept promising more resolution or clarity than it delivered. I am not saying she wanted to give pain to the common reader, though she may have. She may have also been trying to give pleasure to the more sophisticated reader by trying to imitate the way Roland Barthes flattered the educated reader by leaving out obvious transitions. The difference between the way Barthes did it and the way Sontag does it is that Barthes is unfailingly genial in his assertions, which often point courtier-like in two directions of meaning, whereas Sontag's assertions are more blunt and truculent. They stake a claim, then refuse to elaborate, leaving many readers feeling like dumb yokels. So there's a way in which she created an intimidating style. Because I think that she was not following the American and English model of the literary critic and essayist, who's kind of like genial, unbuttoned, see him in a club maybe, you know, clubbable. She was following more the kind of German and French model, which right. was a kind of Mandarin style.
Well, it's funny you mention that because, like, you know, you talk in the book about her aphoristic style and the use of aphorism, the yeah. kind of literary strategy of aphorism.
Right.
And the great aphorist, you know, of my youth was Nietzsche, who is, right. you know, the classic German aphorist.
Exactly. And by aphorism, I just mean a maxim or a short sentence that kind of is very, that's almost like a formula.
Right. Communism know? Is fascism with a human face.
Yeah, that was one. Well, what happened is that the aphorism, which is kind of like, you have to be kind of a lawgiver to write aphorisms. You know, you have to say, you have to lay down the law, basically. And let me say that I think that Nietzsche was the first master for Sontag, the one who formed her thinking. And I also was very, very taken by Nietzsche. So in a funny way, we both came out of Nietzsche, mm-hmm. you know. The aphorism is like, is a kind of willed statement that is always like, half true and half false. You know what I mean? There's always a lot of you know. You take a chance when you do aphorisms, and so she did some very witty aphorisms, but she also would say things that would go too far because she didn't want to qualify. She didn't want to lose energy in her sentences by saying perhaps or it might be the case or sometimes or often. So she would say these things. She would just go for it. You know. And so one of them was communism is fascism with a human face. Another one was when she said that the white race is the cancer of humanity, which was a somewhat unfortunate thing to say, especially if you're white, you know. But anyway, but you know, she wanted to make a point. One of the things that I realized when I was reading through all of Sontag was that Sontag was not a lot of essayists practice this idea of thinking against yourself. They say something and then they kind of argue with themselves. Sontag did not think against herself that much inside the piece. What she would do is she would take a strong stand, and then 10 years later she would write a piece that would take the opposite stand. But she was a kind of an enthusiast. Actually, this is a very simplistic way of saying it, but when I came to thinking, since there's so much in our tastes and in our in our taste and in our approach that overlaps. What really is the difference between Sontag and me? I came to the conclusion that she was an enthusiast and I'm a skeptic. So I kind of, as soon as I hear any kind of dogmatic statement, I start thinking, yes, but.
You know? Right, right.
But Sontag liked to cut to the chase, essentially. And so that meant that sometimes she simplified, you know. She oversimplified. But it came out of a stance that she created a kind of role for herself where she could both be opaque and she could be at times overly simplistic. And sometimes, of course, she could be brilliant and insightful and deliver one amazing insight after another. But a lot of it had to do with the, you might say, the celebrity intellectual role that she created for herself.
Right. And I mean, you talk about certain labels that she used, radical, for instance, right. Serious, which was, as you sort of
radical,
take serious. Apart serious at the end of the book, which made me laugh listening to her describe the role of the writer was to be serious earlier. And I wonder, I mean, particularly that notion of radical, which radical. She used as a kind of a defining
it's interesting.
Metaphor.
Yeah. I think this was also something that I realized again and again, especially in the first half of her career, it was very important for her to be thought of as radical, whether it was in politics or in aesthetics. So, for instance, she took a dislike early on to realism, to humanism, to psychology, all of which she felt was somehow middle brow. She thought that in music you had, you know, Schoenberg and 12-tone music, and in painting you had abstract art. So why were novels still involved with these characters and these situations and these stories? They should be much more abstract,
right.
Much more difficult. And so she looked to people like Alain Robbe Grier and Natalie Sirot and William S. Burroughs, you know, as models. Her biggest insult was to say something was liberal, you know. She wanted to be radical, so she was always looking for the cutting edge, you know. And somebody like that can be incredibly useful and important to a culture. Always looking for the cutting edge, you know. This is a funny thing to say, but I'll say it anyway. I mean, Sontag came out of the West. She came from Arizona and California, and then she came to New York. I grew up in New York City, and I've always thought that people who came from New York City were much more traditional, much less avant-garde. That is, the great figures of the avant-garde, you know, people like Jasper Johns and Andy Warhol and Merce Cunningham. You know,
and Pollock.
And Pollock. Yeah. They came from elsewhere to New York. Whereas the native New Yorkers tended to say, yeah, you know, seen it, the avant-garde, okay, what else is new, you know? Whereas the outsiders were drawn to New York as a place, you know, of modernism, you know?
Well, and also as a kind of canvas, right, a blank canvas where they could create themselves. In some ways, it's the attraction of, you know, those of us who grew up in the East to California as
yes.
well, but you never feel like an insider. You never feel like an insider because you're not.
No. But I guess in some ways I never felt it was an important part of my identity to either to be at the cutting edge or to be radical. You know, I was a kind of wishy-washy left liberal. And for instance, Sontag was in many ways very angry at American, anti-American. And I would think, well, you know, it's not the worst place in the world, you know. Other countries make mistakes too. So there's always been a kind of, I've always felt a kind of more of a kind of moderating sensibility, you know. It doesn't interest me to go out on a limb and to be revolutionary. I you know, I've always sort of counted myself, I guess, a progressive politically, but you know, in my heart of hearts, you know, I didn't want a revolution, you know?
right
because I as I explained to David earlier, I came from working class roots, and I just wanted to get into the middle class, you know. So you know, I didn't want to dismantle the middle class, you know. I wanted to, let me get in first before you start dismantling the bourgeoisie, you know.
Right. Now, I was once teaching a class here where I said this just generally, who in this room wants a revolution? And one guy raised his hand, and I said, really? This is about 2004, 2005. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, you watch TV? He said, yeah. I said, you know, we live in a desert city. You've seen how well they occupy a desert city. So I think I'll stay away from the revolution for the moment. But I wonder, you know, one of the things that interests me about this notion of the kind of her, and in her story particularly, but this notion of kind of the Californian, right, North Hollywood High School, public school, coming to New York and feeling that there was something to prove. I mean, that's part of, you know, you talk in the book about that great essay she wrote for The New Yorker about visiting Thomas Mann when she was a 14-year-old. Just, you know, I will say, at the risk of, you know, putting my cards on the table, that I am one of those readers who always felt that I was being willfully made to feel stupid by Sontag and never cottoned to her. But that piece is beautiful, and it's one of the few pieces where I really see kind of the psychology and the
emotion. It showed what a good
emotion.
What a good personal essay she could be when she wanted to. And it's a very funny piece because she was in Hollywood High, and she worshipped European culture. And she went with a friend, knocked on the door of Thomas Mann, and
who was living in the Pacific Palisades at the time.
And Mann, you know, invited her in, and they had a conversation. Mann saw her as a you know, an interesting specimen of American girlhood. That was the last way Sontag wanted to be seen. you know, he wanted to sort of like, you know, interview her about what it's like to be American, you know, and she just was embarrassed for America. She said that if only Mann knew that the parking lot outside the high school was filled with condoms and stuff like that. Right. She thought it was all very tacky, you know. So she was trying to impress him, and he was trying to impress her. She was embarrassed. She was embarrassed by the West, and there was a whole kind of. I mentioned Pauline Kael, Mary McCarthy, Joan Didion, and Sontag, all of whom came from the West to the East with a kind of chip on their shoulders, you know, with a lot of energy and aggression, you might say.
Right. So I think, I mean, in that sense, I guess that notion of the coming of California, coming from the West with something to prove, explains a lot. It's interesting, her sort of rejection of psychology, because at the risk of sounding like a wishy-washy liberal myself, it all seems to boil down to psychology.
Yeah. Well, for me it does, because I like the notion of psychology, you know, and I remember when I was a teenager and I read Dostoevsky was my idol, and I read the statement where Dostoevsky said, "Why do they call me a psychologist? I'm a realist." And I thought, you know, if I become a writer and they call me a psychologist, I won't take offense, you know. I mean, I grew up in basically, you know, Freudian New York, so This is one of the fascinating things for me in writing the book, because I discovered the position she was taking were kind of in line with certain fashions, you know. So in the early 60s, the Nouveau Roman, Alain Rogrier and Natalie Serot, despised psychology. They wanted to create a novel that where people just acted in the present, and, you know, where you describe the windowsill for 20 pages or whatever. But also, if you think about, you know, films of the 60s like Godard films, you know, Godard's characters never have a mother or father. They just spring fully formed, you know. They don't have grandparents. They don't have roots. So they were kind of always in the existential present, you know. So she liked this idea cutting psychology adrift. But on the other hand, it was something that she did, you know, she partook of. So when she went to Hanoi, for instance, she wrote this book called Trip to Hanoi. And she went to Hanoi, and for the first 35 pages, she basically is retching and complaining that how boring it is, because they're just taking her around, all these commissars are taking her around and showing her like a factory, or showing her, you know, these archetypal revolutionary structures. And they're actually very entertaining, these 35 crutchy pages. And then she does a complete about face and says, you know, like, no, I'm wrong. They are exemplary, and I am a benighted Westerner. And she basically just falls into line. And she realizes that what she missed from the commissars was psychology. They didn't gossip. You know, they just spoke in a Marxist way and they didn't gossip. So, but she wanted the human interest. So even though she claimed she didn't like psychology, a part of her certainly did. But then she wanted to be radical. So she said, okay, why am I being so petty and why am I being so... She wrote a whole passage in that book about how Jewish people suffer more flamboyantly, but the Vietnamese suffered in a more dignified way. You know? So she was basically, you know, saying, "I'm not." You know, she was trying to back off from her Judaism and from her gossipy Yenta side.
So, as a writer addressing her, I'm curious to let me ask you one more question about background, and then we'll go into more of the process stuff. But you knew her over a long period of time. In the book, you talk about meeting her when you were an undergraduate
Yes.
at Columbia, and she was teaching religion there in the early 1960s. And, you know, although you weren't close friends, your paths crossed. You were kept kind of crossing and recrossing over Right. over a period of 40 years or so.
Exactly.
So I'm curious about that and also kind of the balance for you, even before you writing the book, the balance between her as a kind of... a public-private figure, because you knew she wasn't only a public figure to you. She was a private figure as well. You said, you know, there were moments where you actually felt like you were almost being friendly, but then they, you know, they wouldn't gel. This sort of so balancing kind of the public face, the private face, and then the writer face to kind of come up with a three-dimensional sense of her. Do you think that the contradictions are what define that three-dimensional sense?
Well, certainly the contradictions define the three-dimensional sense. That's well put. You should have written this book, actually. But no, just let's hold on to that for a second. What I think, what I, in a way, what this book is showing at the most basic level is the way that the strengths and weaknesses of a person are intertwined, So, you know, they do some things well, they do other things not well, and that contradiction, you know, the people say that the weaknesses of their strengths, or the strengths of their weaknesses, mm-hmm. you know, that's the kind of thing I was trying to show with Sontag. Sontag, for instance, was not a good fiction writer particularly, and I'm not being particularly... original to say that. You know, most people would say that. I sort of summarized why I thought she wasn't a good fiction writer, because she didn't have broad sympathy for other people and because she didn't have a sense of humor. There are actually some very good fiction writers who don't have a sense of humor, but it's rare. But usually they have some kind of sympathy. On the other hand, Sontag was very analytical and very shrewd. So that made her a very good critic and it made her a very good essayist.
Right.
That's an example of how the strengths and weaknesses were combined. For me, I was doing something a little bit different from what I've done in the past. I was basically writing a whole book of literary criticism. But because my training has been as a personal essayist, I knew that there would be sections that would be like a personal essay that would deal with my experiences with Sontag. I didn't want them to take over the book. I would say they represent somewhere between 10 to 12%. Right. And when I finished, when I handed in the manuscript, the editor said, oh, well, we really like those sections. Couldn't you add to them? And I said, no. You know, because in a way... The anecdotes about Sontag tend to repeat themselves, you know. I mean, they tend to come down to the same two or three anecdotes, you know. And I said what I wanted to say.
You mean it played out over a period of time, the same sort of behavior?
The same sort of behavior played out over... let me read from one of those sections, yeah. And maybe you'll get a sense of that, the personal treatment. Okay. As a young woman, especially, Sontag was strikingly good-looking, though I never found her exactly beautiful the way she appeared in her photographs. She always seemed to me at odds with herself, like a female Luftmensch, a Jewish scholar type coming late to sensuality. Perhaps, too, I could never allow myself to be that physically attracted to her because I feared her quickness to dismissal. But I did admire that Sontag was full of life. She had amazing stores of animal vitality, and I think this vitality was the key to what made her feel superior to others, even more than her intelligence. She had a hearty presence in social situations, hearty or impatient, one or the other. The impatience, it seemed to me, was to find the moment when she could release her presentational demon. That was the theatrical side of her, like actors who idle in neutral gear, irritable until they can go on stage or before the camera. Later, when she became an icon, sitting for a Warhol screen test, doing a cameo in Woody Allen's Zelig, or serving as the punchline of New Yorker cartoons and Gremlin 2 jokes. In the movie Gremlin 2, the invading creature spokesman explains, "We want civilization, chamber music, the Geneva Convention Accord, Susan Sontag." And she had that white skunk streak in her hair that made her even more instantly recognizable. She would do this maddening stunt at film screenings. She would come to the first row before the movie started and stroll along the apron of the stage so that everyone could see she was in attendance. And her eyes might rove impatiently over the audience, seeing but not locking eyes with anyone in particular. Those who knew her, friends or acquaintances, would call out, "Susan, Susan," and she refused to acknowledge any of them, to engage these importuning nobodies or so they were left feeling eye contact. In this way, she made herself visually available and yet inaccessible. She came to University of Houston and to be part of the Houston Reading Series. We brought her down. She came down to give a reading and talk to our graduate students. The series was meant to be a prestigious event with only 5 reading slots a year, held in the Museum of Fine Arts Auditorium, designed by Mies van der Rohe. Having Sontag participate in the series was certainly a feather in our cap, and if not quite an honor for her, at least a decent paycheck. She was to spend 2 or 3 days in town. I had arranged for one of our graduate fiction writing students, a woman who had already earned a doctorate in literature and was fluent in French and had read every one of Sontag's books, to pick her up at the airport. Susan seemed testy when I came by for her later that night. "Why'd you get that little housewife to drive me around?" she said. I could only laugh. This was La Sontag when she unhappily found herself outside New York, Paris, or Berlin. An eager, practiced world traveler, ostensibly open to all new experience, she was nevertheless infamously rude to her academic hosts, doing her best imitation of Betty Davis in Beyond the Forest. What a dump. When passing through what she regarded as the American provinces. People I knew used to get together and top each other with stories about how impossible Sontag had been when she visited their campus. Such anecdotes proliferate in Carl Ryerson's and Lisa Paddock's book, Susan Sontag, The Making of an Icon, or in Terry Castle's or Camille Paglia's first-person testimonies. We do not have to rehearse them again, as they all boil down to the same story. Sontag is condescending, curt, and demanding toward those she regards as minions. She arrives late, insults the audience, and gives a perfunctory performance. It does not take much insight to see underneath this contempt a large sense of insecurity at being herself an arriviste in the great world. She did not have that natural aristocratic manner that, for instance, Donald Barthelme displayed, which knew how to put servants and functionaries at ease. She was made of socially coarser stuff. I must say that up to a point, her rudeness never bothered me. I was amused by that impossible side of her, so reminiscent of my own actress mother. And a part of me sympathized with it, having come myself from an even lower, less polished social background than she had. But I also sympathized with those left quaking by her. The misunderstandings that ensued could invariably be traced to the same mistake she made over and over, underestimating the intelligence of others. Once, she was at the New York City Ballet watching Balanchine's Bugaku, a highly exotic, erotic ballet, and she turned to her companion and said, "We are probably the only two people in the audience who realize it's all about sex." Well, no. Most Balanchine lovers perceive the strong sensual undertone in his ballets, and Bugaku is explicitly sexual. Again, when she visited the University of Houston and spoke to my graduate students, she berated them for wanting to become writers when they were so ill-read. "What have you been reading?" she challenged them. And they, polite Southwestern kids for the most part, remained silent, as little apt to brag about their bookishness as Navajo school children would be to yell out the correct answers and embarrass fellow classmates. "You see," she said triumphantly, her suspicions confirmed, "you're not reading enough." Okay, maybe no one is reading enough. But I knew because I had assigned the syllabus that many of them were in fact reading Balzac's Lost Illusions, Walter Benjamin's Study of Baudelaire, Goethe's Italian Journey, André Bielle's St. Petersburg, Tanizaki's The Makioka Sisters, and other works that were right up Sontag's alley. She would never discover that because she had already made up her mind, she would never discover that because she had already made up her mind that they were poorly read. Sontag seemed tense when she arrived in Houston that second visit, and I later discovered it was because she expected to be attacked. Not long before, she had criticized the American left for failing to be honest enough about the horrors of Stalinism and had issued her aphoristic saying, "Communism is fascism with a human face." She had indeed taken some flack in the left-wing press for equating communism with fascism and for seeming to renege on earlier revolutionary socialist sympathies. The point is that she expected to be heckled for her provocative political stance, and she even referred to that controversy in her opening remarks. But of course, no one in Houston knew what she was talking about. Or if a handful did, they were certainly too Southern polite ever to embarrass a distinguished visitor by attacking her in public. If anything, Houston high society, those who went to the opera, the ballet, museum openings, and our reading series, was obsessed with the British royals. A visit from Princess Margaret had generated far more excitement than any left sectarian debate ever could. But Sontag, coming from the rough and tumble of New York literary life, felt vulnerable to ideological attack. And I actually think she was disappointed when none occurred. Before her reading, I took Sontag out to dinner with Carl Killian, a cultured man about town, who owned and ran the Brazos Bookstore, then the unofficial heart of Houston's cultural life. Surrounded by two men, she was flirtatious and even said at one point, "Philip, find me a man." But Susan," I stuttered tactlessly, I thought you were... "Oh, no, it's just that there are no good men available." She had a fair amount of wine to drink, which might not have been such a good thing. When she arrived at the museum auditorium and looked around at the packed adoring house, I sensed her body tense against that Houston crowd. She could really charm an audience, or the opposite. That night, it was the opposite. She announced that she was going to read a story they would probably dislike, the implication being that it would be too cerebral for them or not pandering enough, and proceeded to read it in such a dour, punishing way that her warning became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The next day I met with Sontag to interview her at the request of Carl Killian, who thought it would be useful for the archives. I brought a portable tape recorder with me. Sontag was in good spirits and warm toward me personally, as if acknowledging that in a strange city where she felt ill at ease and knew very few people, I was at least a familiar face, someone on her wavelength. We talked at first about movies, since it was a love we both shared, then about people we knew in common, then about the past, her past. All this while, I had the tape recorder turned off. It was then that she began speaking fondly, to my surprise, about her ex-husband, Philip Reif. The tenderness with which she recalled those days of love and early marriage was so open and forthcoming that I felt we too could have talked for hours. But I needed something for posterity, so I turned on the tape. Instantly she froze. It was striking the way she turned into a rigidly defensive public figure who may as well have been a politician, so wary was she of being misquoted. I tried to get her talking about essay writing, but found her resistant. At that moment, I was in the midst of planning my anthology, The Art of the Personal Essay. I was besotted and saturated with the form. And he was someone who practiced it on such a high level, someone I respected as much as any essayist alive. She could not have been more bored. It was as though I were insulting her innermost core by asking about her essays instead of her fiction. I tried to get her onto the subject of aphorisms, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, knowing how she loved him, as did I. Her responses were brusque. Well, of course, Emerson. What is there to say? Aphorisms, yes, we love them. It was a disaster. I ended up not being able to use any of the interview. Before we parted in Houston, I gave her a signed copy of my most recent book. It may have been either Bachelorhood, my first personal essay collection, or The Rug Merchant, a novel. It was all right to give her the book, but then I expressed a wistful hope that she read it. It was an awkward thing for me to have said, and it came from that old wish that she would finally take in my literary merits, recognize me if not as a peer, then as a fellow practitioner. She immediately crushed that idea by replying, affronted, "I read everything in my library." In other words, rather than acknowledge in human terms my vulnerability regarding her opinion, which lay behind my gauchely expressed wish, she took it as an accusation on my part that she was a slacker, which of course no one would ever reasonably accuse Susan Sontag of being. I'll stop there. So part of what was going on was I was in love with essays, and she had she felt graduated from the essay and turned to fiction.
I wanted to ask you about a couple things in terms of genre. There's a great line, her line in here, where she says that, you know, all writers, I'll paraphrase it badly, but all, you know, the writers when they're working at their best are always creating a new genre, right? Which I think is something you're doing in here, because actually I think that this is, it merges personal essay and criticism, but also works in a novelistic way because you're creating, you're using the contradictions and your own ambivalence to create Sontag as a kind of three-dimensional character. And I'm curious first, and then I do want to talk to you about fiction and essay writing, but first I'm curious about that as a kind of process of creation, about the consciousness or unconsciousness of it and how that kind of developed. You were saying, you said earlier that the book took risks, and I wonder if those are some of the risks you're talking about and,
yes.
And how you go about kind of constructing a book or building that landscape, which seems to be unique to this project.
Yeah, I had started with a few models of writers writing about writers. You know, it's a kind of interesting. There's something inherently erotic in a way about one writer writing about another writer, because, you know, what writers really care about, you know, on the deepest level is literature. They can't help it. You know, they try to hide it from their family, but basically, that's what they care about. So I had read Turgenev's literary reminiscences, where he writes about Belinsky and he writes about Tolstoy and stuff like that. Gorky writing on Chekhov, you know, things like Out of Sheer Rage by Jeff Dyer, Nabokov and Gogol. I was looking at, I'd read all those in the past, and I was, you know, I was experimenting with a form, and the basic thing I was trying to do was to write about things that interested me. So sometimes I would write, let's say, about a book of hers, but sometimes I would write about a theme or an aspect of her. Like I have a section which asks the question: Did she have a sense of humor? And I tried to go into how much or how little she had. She did, but it was a weak sense of humor. That kind of thing. She had a sense of irony, you know, which in a pinch could work for humor. So I was really, I have to say that one of the things that drives me as a writer is to be mischievous. That, like, you know, when I get up out of bed in the morning, I may be as grumpy as anybody, but then I think, oh, good, I'm going to be mischievous today. And that is something that is the carrot for me, you know. So it was fun for me to write that description of her coming to Houston and of, you know, that kind of, you know, miscommunication, you know. So I thought I'm going to put this together with different pieces, you know, different sections, and build a double portrait, in effect, because I can't do it without also talking about myself in a way, you know. And you know, when I question an idea of hers, I have to say, well, you know, yes, but this, I don't really believe that, you know. Mm-hmm. So for me, part of the risk was to say, what do I really believe, not what does my peer group tell me I should believe, you know. So for, you know, one little example would be just, you know, I wrote this book, you know, in the last year and a half of the Bush administration, you know, when you know, I and my peer group were as disgusted as would be possible to be with a Washington administration. And yet there's always been this sort of weird patriotic side of me where I don't like to denounce America, you know. I just think, well, I'm not going to confuse the president with the people, you know. So I had to think, what do I actually think, not what does my group tell me to think, you know. And I did that with practically every sentence she wrote all the way down the line. So I was continuously interrogating myself, you know. Why does this seem powerful, even if wrong-headed, this passage by her? Why does this other thing seem fishy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you reread everything?
I reread everything.
So you didn't go the Nicholson Baker route, right? You know, in You and I, he reread nothing.
Yeah, that's another book, by the way, that I thought of, is Nicholson Baker's You and I, his book about Updike. Which I like very much. I think it's
right. But he, part of his conceit is that he doesn't read any of the books he hasn't read. He doesn't go back and read anything, and then he claims to. And I never went through closely enough to verify, but he claims to quote from memory, so he gets stuff wrong, because it's more important how the work has transmuted itself into his experience.
I went through everything. I read everything. I underlined it. I took notes. You know, And then at the end, I was completely saturated. I was walking around like a sponge with Sontag in my head all the time, you know.
And did it, I mean, is it, was it daunting? Not, I mean, not just because she's a figure of that kind of stature, yeah, and a really defining figure in some way. I think what Louise was saying about this book functioning both as notes on a writer and a kind of social history of, yeah, an intellectual period is yeah, true. But because she's been so written about, and even by herself, as you say, she would go back and, right, argue with her pieces. Was that in any way daunting or off-putting to kind of take on such a much regarded iconic figure?
I mean, it was fun, you know. It really was. I read everything over. Yeah. Fortunately, it's not an enormous. It's not like, you know, Balzac or something like,
right,
that. So I could read everything, and I began to see what her moves were. This is actually what interested me a great deal. As an essayist, I was studying a fellow practitioner who I thought was a remarkably good practitioner. So I wanted to see how she would build pieces. I came to the conclusion that her greatest achievements were these 20 to 30 page essays, these 25 page essays, where she would go in and she would really nail it. You know, like what she does with Fascinating Fascism or Notes on Camp. You know, these were wonderful pieces. The title, let's say, Against Interpretation, the piece she did on Walter Benjamin, these are great. She would take very complex subjects and she would really... she would condense. They were like these pocket biographical essays or real thought pieces. And so I realized that in her book-length essays, like On Photography or Illness as Metaphor, I felt like some of her, they became shrill because it wasn't what she did best. Being a condensed aphoristic writer, it made sense that her best pieces would be on the short side, not the longest ones.
Right. And yet the irony, or even maybe the tragedy, is that, as you say in the book, that she didn't realize, or she didn't value that in the way that you think she ought to have, right? She was enthralled to the novel.
I think the culture didn't. I mean, you know, I list some of the writers who I think were better nonfiction writers than they were fiction writers. James Baldwin being an obvious example.
Right.
Mary McCarthy, Gore Vidal, probably Norman Mailer.
Yeah, Mailer certainly, I think. And then we were talking before about Didion, William Gass.
William Gass, Truman Capote. You know, there was a whole generation who were wonderful, alive, you know, their voices were so alive in their essays and their nonfiction work. But the status was all in fiction, you know. And this is, you know, when you see lists of Lannan Awards or any of those things, MacArthur Awards, you know, you see basically, you know, fiction, poetry, and then you see nonfiction is like this, you know, essays, maybe one or two. You know, when was the last time a nonfiction writer won the Nobel Prize, for instance?
Right, and certainly not an essayist. If it's going to be a nonfiction, it's going to be a big, it'll be the big canvas. You know, even Mailer, when he won his prizes, won for big nonfiction books like Armies of the Night.
Right, yeah. Which is a wonderful book.
Yeah.
So she wasn't alone in, she perfected this form, which was the 25-page essay. Right. And I think that those first three collections especially will, you know, deserve to be part of the American canon. You know, the canon of American nonfiction literature. They're there. No one can take it away from her.
Right. And I guess the last question I'd ask, and we'll turn it over to questions from you guys, is that it seems like a lot of those writers that you're talking about, and Sontag certainly, were writers who actively responded to their time, to their moment.
Yes.
I mean, writers as public figures, and that is what fueled their nonfiction.
Yes.
I wonder if that, too, or if you think that had some kind of relationship to the kind of explosion of a particular kind of consciousness in the late 50s and 60s in terms of, you know, skeptical, critical looking at the official story and trying to see beneath it, which it seems that all of those writers' nonfiction somehow shares in common, Mailer, Sontag.
Well, I think that the post-war period in America, 1945 to, say, 65, was a golden age of nonfiction prose. And some of it had to do with the emigres who were coming over here, you know, and who kind of brought a lot of, raise the intellectual standard, you might say, fleeing Hitler, and some of them, some of it had to do with that it was the American moment, the American century, the American moment, and I mean, I think that people do a disservice to the 50s when they talk about it as a conformist time, because there were a lot of dissenting voices out there, and it was a period when you had a lot of literary quarterlies. You know, Partisan Review was hot stuff, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, Philip Roth was like a rock star, you know, hard to imagine, but, you know. So, yes, it was a period when there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of literary culture, a lot of literary magazines. So there was room to be a public intellectual. I think what happened to my generation, which came after, was that we, for instance, what I would think of as a generation of the 60s that protested the Vietnam War and everything, oddly enough, we protested, we got arrested, but we didn't feel as comfortable mouthing off, you know? We didn't feel as comfortable taking our place at the table as public intellectuals. You know, and I think, you know, I certainly felt like that I couldn't just repeat a political line, you know. I remember for me, of course, with Cambodia, that was kind of a turning point for me because, you know, there was these rumors that there was this kind of genocide and people were being killed. And then, you know, like the radical left was saying, oh, don't believe that. That's just the New York Times, you know, it's just... You know, they're against it because it's a revolutionary society, you know. But in fact, people were being killed, you know, huge massacres. So I thought, I have no right to talk about this. I remember thinking, should I write a piece against apartheid? I thought, well, what do I have to say that could be authentic, that could be against? I'm against apartheid, you know, what do I have to say? But it didn't seem to stop people like Mary McCarthy and Susan Sontag. And
well, I wonder if that's just evolutionary, though, coming back to the kind of critical consciousness that, you know, writing about the culture in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, those writers were staking out a kind of critical stance. And then the next generation, your generation, just staking out the critical stance wasn't enough. It's sort of like you're saying, you had to think about what your group was saying and then what you were saying, that they didn't necessarily have to be the same thing. It wasn't enough just simply to be critical.
Exactly.
You had to look further.
Yeah, and I think that started an adventure in personal writing.
Yeah.
But also, let's give them credit. They did it so well, we didn't have to do it.
Right. Well, with that, let's turn it over to questions from the audience for a few minutes. There's a microphone. So raise your hand and we'll call on you.
Comments as well.
Yes. Hi. I feel compelled to bring up the question of her being a woman and what it was like for her to be heard
yeah.
at the time that she first started writing.
No question. I mean, her, you know, she created an image of a woman who was intellectually secure, didn't have to be apologetic, sexually free. It was a new kind of woman. She became a role model and a heroine, I think, for many, many women, you know. I think it's certainly true that part of her insistence came from having to push her way into an all-male world. Same thing with Mary McCarthy. Same thing with Pauline Kael. No question about it.
Elizabeth Hardwick was one of my very, very favorite teachers at Barnard.
Right.
And whenever I'd go out, Lizzie would call me over and say, I want you to meet Susan Sontag. And I was terrified in ways that I am of all literary personas. I probably learned as much from your writing or Lizzie's writing as I have from Susan Sontag's. Wouldn't think twice about asking either of you a question or coming up and talking to you.
Right.
And it always just struck me, you know, here was Elizabeth Hardwick, who was the way she was, and here was Susan Sontag. And I was always trying to put that friendship together. Were you able to see something in that friendship?
Sontag really admired Elizabeth Hardwick, you know. She admired her. She was one of the only American writers for Sontag admired, contemporaries. And she admired not just her criticism, but Sleepless Nights, the novel. I think that in some ways Sontag looked up to Elizabeth Hardwick, you know. I love Elizabeth Hardwick's prose style. I think she's a wonderful prose writer, you know. I think she's a more consistently elegant stylist than Sontag. Sontag can be very clumsy sometimes. She can be good, then she can be clumsy. But Hardwick had this amazing flute-like sound that she could produce all the time, you know.
I'm partway through the book, so I have a feeling this is going to get answered, and you know, in the course of the book, and to some degree, you may have already answered it. But I love the approach, you know, of the jazz riffs. But I was reading the thing on the Bette Noirs, her sort of just rejection as you were ticking them off of realism, humanism, psychology, and naturalism, and I thought, well, there you have it. This is why this woman has gotten on my nerves, so for a humanist, who as I get older, I. My undergraduate degree is in psychology, and it seemed silly for years, and now I think, you know, it's everything. And what's the best way in to Sontag, who is this woman of astonishing talents? And I mean, I'm hearing from what you're saying, you know, maybe the essays, but when you brought up Cambodia, I thought, right, that's the one and only time I really truly had writer's block, because I went over there as people were gushing out after the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge, and nothing I could say seemed important enough. Now I was young and, you know, I thought I had to change everything. But it's as if she didn't feel that obligation at all.
Well, no, I mean, first of all, she changed a lot. I mean, one of the things that happened was, as a writer, her novels got more realistic because her first few novels were so were so hard to take that she realized that she's going to have to, you know, her best novel is The Volcano Lover, and it's much more in a traditional style than, let's say, Death Kit or The Benefactor. So she had to realize that, you know, maybe there were two sides to the story. And then as far as humanism was concerned, she lived long enough. She went to, Sarajevo, and she discovered over time that there are worse things in the world than humanism, you know, in the late 20th century, you know. I mean, so for instance, in her first book about photography, On Photography, she attacks the presumptions of humanists, photographic humanism. Then when she wrote the second book regarding the pain of others, she was much more sympathetic to that, partly because she went to Sarajevo and people there were saying, we want our pictures to be taken. We want this story to get out. We want people, you know, so she realized that you know, there was a function in the photography, you know, as she understood with the Abu Ghraib photographs also. So she came to change, but she never liked to admit that she was wrong, you know. Unlike me, for instance, you know. No, I mean, that's human, you know. She didn't like to admit that she was wrong. But she did change, you know. And I think that the best, I mean, for me, the best way to approach Sontag would be to read those first three essay collections, Against Interpretation, Styles of Radical Will, and Under the Sign of Saturn. But then you can read everything else of hers, because I think she is ultimately a very human writer. And once you understand what her mannerisms are and what her defenses are, then you can forgive and you can get a lot out of it. I ended up being touched by her because I felt that she, I mean, I found her touching in a way because she did have to defend herself so much, you know. Yeah. Right. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you. Philip, talk a little bit about, David asked you about putting the book together and you said it was fun and you just had the novels come out.
Yeah.
And you're talking sort of about essays and fiction, and I wonder now if you love essays the way you did and if you continue to read them or if you prefer to read fiction.
I prefer to read essays and novels. How's that for an honest answer? That is, I'm now reading, on the airplane over, I started Little Dorrit by Dickens, which I'd never read, which is terrific, you know, but I'd never read it. So I tend to read long novels and to read lots of essays. So when I get a magazine, for instance, a literary magazine, it's shameful to admit this, but I skip the short stories. I don't read them. I just read the essays, let's say. And then I read novels, you know. So I'm still filling in my gaps, you know.
And what about the writing?
The writing, I mean, I guess I always feel that that essays are easier and more natural for me to write than fiction. But the novellas got a very good response, and so my wife said, so now you're going to be writing fiction a lot, right? You know. But in fact, I think, well, I'll write a novel in 10 years, you know. Every 10 years I'll write a novel, you know. But I do feel that I love the sound of someone thinking on the page. That's very attractive to me. I even like fiction writers who can be essayistic at times, you know. So I'll always be drawn to that, I think, you know. But of course, my first loves were fiction and poetry, you know. As I said to David earlier, no 13-year-old kid says, I want to grow up and be an essayist, you know. Oh, something weird about that kid, you know. I'd keep an eye on him. But, you know, fiction is entering a world that's very satisfying.
Susan Sontag was sort of avowedly an impersonal essayist, and
yes.
And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
I do. Yes. I mean, in fact, she had many negative things to say about personal writing and autobiographical writing. Increasingly, as she got older, she kind of turned up her nose at the fashion for the memoir and for personal essays and so on. And I, being a personal essayist, don't feel like that autobiographical writing needs to apologize for itself. I think it's a valid genre. But I also think that Sontag, a number of times, wrote beautifully on a personal level. Her essay on Paul Goodman, for instance, is a beautiful essay. She has an essay on questions of travel where she deconstructs her earlier naivete to communist countries. And she has the essay about visiting Thomas Mann. She did some wonderful things in that. She made herself into a satisfying first-person character. But she certainly spoke out a lot against personal writing. And I do think that that's a kind of snobbish position, like, you know, who are these nobodies who are claiming our attention, you know. And I think flat out she was wrong in thinking that that personal writing is somehow, you know, self-indulgent, or it means, you know, you can use personal writing to explore the world. You know, you don't have to just explore your navel. You know, if done well, it's excellent. And there are probably as many bad novels out there as percentage-wise as there are bad memoirs. You know, so. I've done both. I mean, I have swung both ways. I have invented, and I've also written close to autobiographical fact. So I do think that the personal was something that she struggled with. At the beginning, when she first began, she was much more friendly to the idea of that you write about yourself, you know. But then, as she became a public figure, she began to be weighed down by this carapace, or whatever you want to call it, this shell of the public Susan Sontag. And she occasionally would write about how she wasn't that person. She wasn't the person in her books, you know. And so she did everything she could to get attention, but then she didn't like it in a certain way, you know. But I do think that she began to struggle with not just with the personal, but with the role that she had helped create for herself and that society had created for her.
Actually, I think Mary McCarthy's The 17th Degree is possibly more embarrassing even than Trip to Hanoi. But I had another question on originality. Am I misremembering? I mean, for a writer who's that original, weren't there some issues involving...
Yes.
Yeah, Susan Sontag relying a little too heavily on somebody else's diaries and coming to America. Why would a very original writer do that?
Well, I mean...
Plagiarism is one of my new interests.
I'm not a big Law and Order guy, actually, although I like the TV show Law and Order. But I think that... this was basically toward the end of her life, and some of it had to do with stuff that went into a novel in America, but some of it also had to do with a piece she was writing about hypertext, where she seemed to actually quoted without attribution somebody else's work. And I will only take her side and say she was old, she was ill, and, you know... maybe she didn't quite realize what she was doing, but that's only at the end of her life that happened. So, I'd cut her some slack.
Probably not as erudite as many of the other people here, but I wonder if her ambition was to sort of become an Emerson for her era. I mean, you had mentioned that, the nature of her essays were sort of writ large in that kind of way. And I think of Emerson to me as this like very indispensable person that for some strange reason is somehow not taught enough in American schools or is not as much of a touchstone as he should be. And you mentioned the 50s and that period of time. And so I just wondered if you could elaborate on that, if that was sort of what was propelling her in some sort of way. Because
she
have that sort of thing.
I think she was much more wanting to be a Roland Barthes or a Walter Benjamin, you know. But I have tried teaching Emerson, and I think Emerson is hard to teach because his thought is so condensed that, you know, when they teach freshman comp, they teach thesis statement and the 5-paragraph essay. Well, when you read Emerson, it's one thesis statement after another, you know. It's just it's so condensed, you know. It's like poetry, essentially, you know. So he does what Emily Dickinson does. He makes the top of your head feel like it's spinning off when you read him, you know. So, well,
thank you all very much, and thank you, Philip.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.